Time for a weekly review of state news. An influential business group has taken back its endorsement of a state Supreme Court candidate. A Wisconsin high school football player returns safely after going missing and shares his mental health concerns. And a healthcare merger is causing problems for some Wisconsin cancer patients. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us most Fridays to look at the top news from around the state. Rob, good to have you back.
Hey, thank you.
Let's start with this state Supreme Court race, two candidates in the upcoming election. And now one of the candidates, one of his key donors, has taken back its endorsement and is asking for its money back. What happened?
Right. So Judge Brian Hagedorn is continuing fallout for advocacy of socially conservative causes. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has reported on public statements he's made online and policy of a private school he founded that is seen as homophobic, and most recently reported that he had received about $3,000 for giving speeches to an activist conservative legal group that has supported making gay sex a crime. That is the Alliance Defending Freedom. So this is like an ally of his. He's sort of in line with the reporting of about statements that he's made. And this week, some concrete political fallout as the Wisconsin Realtors Association rescinded its endorsement and is asking the campaign to return $18,000 that they had donated.
Now, what has the Hagedorn campaign had to say as these issues have been raised over the last week or two?
So Hagedorn's position is that these are attacks on his faith, on people of faith, rather than attacks on his objectivity or, like, you know, in the text of the statement that the Realtors Association put out was that they didn't want to be associated with, you know, they had endorsed him over some real estate related issues. They didn't have a position or want to be associated with the other stuff. The campaign's position is that these are attacks on him as a person of faith, and, you know, politically he needs people on the right to be fired up to vote in the spring election, so that's where he's targeting his political appeals.
We'll keep watching as that story develops. Some reporting this week, Rob, on healthcare mergers. We see healthcare groups merge and buy each other out all the time, but that can have consequences, it turns out, for patients, including, in the reporting this week, cancer patients. Can you tell us this story?
Right. This is a complicated story, but a significant one. My colleague Maureen Wallenfang out of Appleton interviewed numerous patients who had been patients at a clinic called Fox Valley Hematology and Oncology that was bought out by ThetaCare, which is a hospital system, a much larger healthcare organization. And what this, you know, what her interviews showed, what the reporting shows, is the numerous, you know, problems, complications that came to these patients for, over the course of this changeover. So some had their insurance rejected or saw higher costs. Some were more minor but clearly annoying things, like appointment times would go missing or they had to change their schedules. And in one case, a patient's medical records reviewed by USA Today Network Wisconsin appeared to show that she had been given the wrong dosage of a medication for a period of months.
So dealing with cancer treatment, tough enough in any circumstance, it sounds like these patients dealing with their cancer treatment and dealing with this new bureaucracy, I guess, extra trouble for them.
Right. So, and you know, as you say, you know, mergers in healthcare, this is what is the healthcare field is seeing in general. This is one case of an independent clinic that was bought out by a hospital system, but that is a very common story. And so every time it happens, there's going to be an inevitable transition period, changes to computer systems and staff payments and whatever, insurance, all the things that make our health system so complex and so sometimes so frustrating for patients. So as an organization, the hospital system can, like, work through these issues, look at its procedures or whatever, but if you are the patient or if it's your loved one who's relying on these institutions for cancer treatment. You know, it's it just is a reminder of how high the stakes are for these people, and they may not feel like they can wait the 6 months or whatever it takes to sort of work out these logistical issues.
Talking to Rob Metzer from USA Today Network. Wisconsin rounding up some of the top news around the state this week. Rob, a lot of attention to this last Sunday, an alarm raised that a Stevens Point High School student and football player was missing. What happened? What was the outcome?
Right. So Jackson Kelly, who is 18 years old, is safe. He is at home. And I mean, that's the most important thing. He went missing on Sunday and was found on Tuesday. He wasn't hurt. He's okay. And then what happened this week was on Thursday, he posted a statement on his Twitter feed about what he had been through. And essentially he went through a mental health crisis. He wrote about suffering from anxiety and depression, and that he hadn't been sleeping, and he went into a episode he described as extreme paranoia and a dark place inside his mind, and that led him to run away. He believed he was being chased by someone. He said he drove more than 1,000 miles during the time that he was missing. But he also wrote that he was able to get his, you know, mental bearings. He was able to come back, and he wrote in the same statement that he's learned the importance of not keeping things bottled up, the importance of talking to others about your mental health. And I mean, I think he did that's a brave thing to share that publicly. I think he's done a good thing there, and maybe something that can reach others.
Want to touch on a couple more stories, Rob, before we run out of time. A Wisconsin high school showing up in the New York Times for not a great reason. Some strange awards at a cheerleading banquet. This happened last year. Just came out in the papers this week. What was the story?
Yeah, I think this was first reported in the New York Times, and the reason that it was reported was because the ACLU had sent a letter of warning to a high school in Kenosha after they did this banquet for cheerleaders and gave out these sort of jokey awards to the cheerleaders that were all based around their bodies. They had jokey awards about the skinniest girl and the most well-endowed girl and things that are like, you know, it wasn't in the spirit of, you know, intentional bullying, but like it's pretty plainly inappropriate among high school girls. And there were certainly some parents and attendees at this sort of end of the year banquet that found it to be totally out of line and complained to the school. And the ACLU's position is that that the school did not take sufficient action.
And yeah, what has the response been from the school now since this reporting came out?
Well, they don't want to talk. They're not going to comment on a personnel issue, but it looks like they're going to make some changes. I think it's safe to say that we will not see the same awards as a result. But I mean, it's a question of whether that's more the result of this publicity or of something else.
And briefly, Rob, a Wisconsin teacher is out with a new book that is telling what for me was an untold story. A big shipwreck as part of Civil War history. I think we're going to try to get this teacher on, by the way. But briefly, remind us or tell us what happened with this ship.
Yeah, I found this story fascinating. Yeah, Paul Tim is an eighth grade teacher at Random Lake Middle School, and he wrote about the Lady Elgin. We and my colleague Diana Dombrowski in the Sheboygan Press wrote a fascinating story this week. Folks can look up the Lady Elgin shipwreck. This happened in 1860, and 300 people lost their lives in the shipwreck. It was a steamship that was on its way back to Milwaukee from a political rally in Chicago, and it's all tied up into Civil War history. There's drama to the wreck, and this it's become the subject of this teacher's young adult novel, and it sounds fascinating.
We'll check that out more. Rob, thanks as always. Have a good weekend.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Metzer with USA Today Network, Wisconsin, for our weekly roundup of state news. It's time for Wisconsin Life. This week, we get an inside look at America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
In 1930, three black teenagers were accused of murder in Indiana. After their arrest, an angry mob dragged two of the young men out of the jail and lynched them next to the courthouse. Then they came for the third boy, 16-year-old James Cameron. Here he is telling his story on WHYY's Fresh Air.
And then they began to yell for me like a favorite basketball or football player. They said, "We want Cameron, we want Cameron." And as the police cleared the path, I looked over into the faces of people as they were beating me along the way up to the tree. I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. They got me up to the tree, and someone said, "Where's the rope?" They got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, "Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins. I was ready to die."
But you heard a voice. What did the voice say?
The voice said, "Take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing."
Miraculously, the crowd let him go. Dr. James Cameron is supposedly the only person to survive a lynching in the United States. Cameron dedicated his life to sharing his story, the civil rights movement, and eventually landed in Milwaukee, where he founded America's Black Holocaust Museum. The museum's head griot, Reggie Jackson, says Cameron was moved after a trip to a Holocaust memorial in Israel with his wife.
And while they were standing there, they were both in tears, and he turned to his wife, Virginia, and he said, "Virginia, we need a museum like this in America to tell what happened to black people and all of those freedom-loving whites that have been with us along this journey."
He didn't start the museum until he was 74 years old.
That's America's Black Holocaust Museum virtual curator, Fran Kaplan.
He bought a boxing gym for a dollar. He had been collecting for years artifacts that people would send him. Things like Ku Klux Klan outfits that they found in their attics in Milwaukee.
People from around the world came to this small museum in Milwaukee to hear the stories that Dr. Cameron shared. It became really something very unique because it was a telling of American history from a different perspective than the majority of us have ever had.
The museum's doors stayed open in the Bronzeville neighborhood for 20 years. It closed after Cameron passed away in 2006 at age 92.
So we have this exhibit which talks about life in Africa.
The museum has been resurrected. It's housed in a new physical building, but its doors are not open yet. Organizers continue to raise money to finish the displays and create an endowment. Jackson gives me a tour of some of the displays featuring African empires, slavery, and the Jim Crow era.
And as you kind of get further into the museum, probably the most emotional part of the former museum was our simulated slaving ship.
Dr. Cameron's legacy lives on in this new museum.
He said on many, many occasions that the museum is designed to help people. It's not designed to hurt anybody. It's not designed to make people feel uncomfortable. This is as American as any other part of our history.
People are looking to change what's happening in race relations in this country. And Dr. Cameron was way out ahead of this. He emphasized that the truth would set you free.
This man who survived a lynching at the age of 16, who was forced to witness a lynching at the age of 8, found a way to not be a hateful person, found a way to take tragic events that happened in his life and use that experience, those emotions, to grow into a person who wanted to make the world better for everybody.
Go to our website, wisconsinlife.org, where you can learn so much more about Dr. James Cameron's life and the eventual reopening of America's Black Holocaust Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now Reggie Jackson, the museum's head griot, joins us from our Milwaukee studios. Reggie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
I want to talk about your title a little bit because I think it's an important part of the story. You're a griot, which is a long tradition. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The docents at the museum are known as griots, and we borrow that name from the Oral historians of the French-speaking part of West Africa, they use the word griot to describe the people who are the keepers of the history. And so Dr. Cameron wanted all of the docents at the museum to be known as griots.
It seems like, I'll speak for myself, I have a historical gap when it comes to African-American history. There's slavery and there's the Civil War, and then there's the Civil Rights Movement, especially when it got, you know, it's in the 60s. And then I don't know as much as I feel like I should about that century in between. Do we have kind of gaps in our historical knowledge here?
Yeah, there's a huge gap. That's probably the least known part of African-American history in the country is what happened after slavery ended in 1865 up until Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama. And so those years, those decades are really some of the more challenging decades for African-Americans in the country. A lot of really, really horrific things happen that people don't learn about in school. And so they really don't understand the difficulties that we deal with today have been, affected not just by slavery, but by things that happened after slavery. We are aware that slavery ended with the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, but there was a provision in the 13th Amendment that allowed slavery to continue for people who had been convicted of crimes. And so one of the systems that developed was called the convict lease system. And that was a system where black men and children, young boys, could be pulled off of the street, charged with a fictitious crime, and then forced to work with someone for free. And that system was in place throughout the South for many years, all the way through the 1930s. So slavery really existed much longer than we typically been led to believe. There's also a great deal of violence against blacks after the Civil War ended, once the last federal troops were taken out of the South. In 1876, vigilante groups and terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan began to really make sure that blacks could not really enjoy those new freedoms they had been given, the right to vote, citizenship rights. And so we began to see a period of violence that really grew tremendously, primarily lynchings that took place across the country, not just in the South, but in the North as well. From 1880 until 1960, there were about 5,000 lynchings that took place. A majority of those victims of lynchings were blacks. It was very rare for anyone to be charged for murdering people in those lynchings. And you also had race riots that occurred throughout the country where whites left their communities and went into black communities and beat, killed people, looted their property, burned their property. The most famous of those is probably the Tulsa, Oklahoma race riot, which occurred in 1921. 35 square blocks of Tulsa was destroyed. It was known as by many as Black Wall Street. It was a thriving business district there. The largest black-owned hotel in the country was there. And so those things are left out of our history classes and our history textbooks. And so people don't really understand what was going on. They don't understand that black GIs coming back from World War II, at least 13 of them were lynched in their uniforms. People aren't aware that here in Milwaukee, that a lynching took place in 1861. And I heard you speaking earlier about the Lady Elgin. That story is actually directly connected to the lynching that happened in Milwaukee. A man by the name of George Marshall Clark was lynched right on Water Street in Milwaukee in 1861. And so the Civil Rights Movement really came out of a lack of understanding by many people of why we needed new laws. We had been given freedom. We had a civil rights law that was passed in 1875. So a lot of those rights that we thought we had, we weren't receiving. And a lot of things happened to, you know, prevent us from moving ahead. There were policies on the state, local, and federal level that prevented us from living in particular neighborhoods and becoming homeowners. The home ownership rate among blacks today is very low as a result of decades of policies like redlining, the use of racial restrictive covenants. And so I always tell people that one of the things we talk about at the museum is that we challenge people to understand why was the civil rights movement even necessary if we had laws in place to protect us. And those are some of the things that Dr. Cameron believed if people understood that history better, that 100 years in particular, then they would understand that, you know, the conditions that we live under today were directly implicated or directly impacted, rather, by many, many decades of really horrific conditions and bad treatment of blacks throughout the country that really resurface on a regular basis when we have conversations about these things. But we want the people who visit the museum, whether it be the online museum or the physical museum, to understand that the reason we teach this history, the reason that Dr. Cameron wanted people to learn it, was so that we could work on having better conversations about race. We don't have good conversations because people don't know enough. They don't know enough of the history to really have productive conversations. And Dr. Cameron wanted those conversations, people to visit the museum, to leave and have conversations with people that they knew, to work towards one simple goal, to build towards racial repair and reconciliation. We don't believe that you can have repair and reconciliation without truth first, though.
And Reggie, in our last minute, as you work to reopen the museum, briefly, how will you be telling these stories there?
We will have griots at the museum who will be there to give tours. I'm actually working on the curriculum for them right now. There'll also be self-guided tours. We're preparing literature for the self-guided tours at the museum. So it'll be a good experience for people to come and learn, you know, pieces of this history from the exhibits that are there, obviously, but also to have a griot there to answer additional questions they have.
Reggie, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
That's Reggie Jackson with America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee with us to talk about what we can expect with the reopening of the museum. You can keep an eye on their website for more information about when the museum will be open to the public at abhmuseum.org. And the virtual tour, of course, is open there as well. Now, with the Oscars just around the corner and movie fever at high pitch, you know, maybe for you if you're into movies, I don't know, let's have a special movie-themed edition of Wisconsin Life.
The 91st Academy Awards ceremony is happening this Sunday, which got Dean Robbins thinking about movies set in and around Madison. It's always a thrill to see Wisconsin's capital city as a backdrop for a major motion picture. Or is that really Madison we're seeing?
I guess I should be glad that Hollywood is interested in Madison. For a mid-sized city tucked away in the heartland, my hometown is figured in a surprising number of major movies. But most of them utterly fail to capture Madison on screen. One of the worst insults to civic pride is setting a movie in Madison, but filming the scenes elsewhere. In Away We Go, John Krasinski and Maya Rudolph consider settling here to raise a family. In The Prince and Me, Julia Stiles attends the University of Wisconsin-Madison and falls in love with a Danish prince.
What the hell was that? Why were they calling you Prince Edward?
That's my name.
What? That's crazy. You're a prince and that's why they were taking photos of us?
Yes.
Are there a lot of princes where you're from, or are you kind of it?
In each case, the locations look nothing like the real Madison, which couldn't feel weirder to a local viewer. Where'd my city go? Just as bad are movies filmed in Madison that claim to be happening somewhere else. For example, the period gangster film Public Enemies features the Wisconsin State Capitol, but only as a stand-in for the U.S. Capitol and FBI headquarters. The timeless marble interior almost convinces you you're in Washington, D.C. in the 1930s. That is, until FBI agent Christian Bale faces reporters outside the building. In the background are modern-day Madison storefronts. Oops.
Well, nevertheless, we will get it.
What makes you so sure?
We have two things Dillinger does not.
What are they?
The Bureau's modern techniques of fighting crime scientifically, and the visionary leadership of our director, J. Edgar Hoover.
Ironically, Hollywood movies both shot and set in Madison are the worst of the bunch. In theory, locals would enjoy seeing Bascom Hill as itself in Four Keeps, starring Molly Ringwald as a pregnant UW-Madison student. The same goes for the Memorial Union Terrace in The Last Kiss, in which Zach Braff gets mixed up in a campus romance. And then there's King Street in I Love Trouble, which finds reporters Julia Roberts and Nick Nolte covering a story in Wisconsin.
Oh, perfect. We're going to pass by the best frozen yogurt joint in the entire state.
Yeah? It's on Peterson.
You okay?
What the hell was that all about?
No argument with the authentic locations in these productions, but the plots and the acting are so bad that you feel embarrassed on the city's behalf. It's hard to believe, but Madison's one shining moment in Hollywood movies is Back to School, a 1986 Rodney Dangerfield comedy. The film won no awards for its crude story of a millionaire who joins his son as a freshman at UW-Madison, renamed Grand Lakes University.
Hey, folks, it's on me, Shakespeare for everyone, okay?
Who is that?
That is Mr. Thornton Mellon, the world's oldest living freshman.
But Dangerfield works hard for laughs, and he gets just enough of them. From the local perspective, though, the film's real charm is its loving view of Madison. Here, the city pretends to be nothing other than itself, and it's never looked better on screen. Residents will recognize the unique light of fall semester, with leaves crunching underfoot. This time, picturesque buildings like the Red Gym and Science Hall aren't just cameos, but stars of the show. Just when you start thinking you'd love to live in such a dreamy place, you realize, to your amazement, that you do.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now we'll stay with the movie theme for the week. Not talking about this year's Oscars necessarily. We have a question for you now. What is your favorite movie to go back and re-watch? A second time? Third time? Once a year? Twice a year? What is the movie you love or movies to re-watch? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Is there a holiday movie that you watch maybe every Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's with friends or family? Is there a favorite comedy with lines that you remind yourself of again and again? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. As your calls come in, a couple of my own that I thought of. I don't do this, I will say, as much as I used to. One that I seem to keep going back to is Shaun of the Dead lately, the Simon Pegg zombie comedy movie. That does keep me coming back again and again. And when my kids were little, I was too lazy to get up and change the DVD, so I ended up watching Kids in the Hall Brain Candy again and again, a source of many a catchphrase around here at the Ideas Network. Call in now, 800-642-1234, with the movie you love to re-watch. We'll be taking your calls through the remainder of this hour. Let's go to our callers now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, thanks for getting us started. What do you got for us?
Hi. My favorite I love to watch with my family at Christmas time is While You Were Sleeping with Bill Pullman and Sandra Bullock, because they seem like such ordinary people, and you can see your own family in them, and of course it is a comedy, but that's our Christmas classic.
And the whole family gets behind doing that every year?
Well, my kids and I, there aren't grandchildren yet, but we've been watching that at Christmas time since it came out.
While You Were Sleeping. Gwen, thank you so much for calling in and getting us started. We'll go now to Poppy in Madison. Poppy, hi.
Hi.
What's your rewatch movie?
Grosse Pointe Blank, and it stars John Cusack, Minnie Driver, and Dan Aykroyd. And John Cusack is a hitman who goes to his 10-year high school reunion.
Grosse Pointe Blank. This is a movie I have seen multiple times, I will admit. Now, I got to ask, were you a teenager in the 80s, Poppy, like I was?
I was.
Yep.
Yes.
So the soundtrack, I mean, and that's not your stereotypical 80s top hit soundtrack. There's a lot of good 80s music in that movie.
Excellent, excellent soundtrack, yes.
And so how often do you watch Gross Point Blank?
Oh, probably once a month at this point.
Wow, okay.
Yep, that or maybe a little longer sometimes, but I could watch that over and over and over. I have it memorized.
Fantastic. We do have on CD both of the soundtracks for that. That was in our driving rotation for a long time. Poppy, thank you so much for calling in at 800-642-1234. We're asking you about the movies. It's Oscar season, right? We're asking about the movies you like to re-watch again and again, once a year or once a month, as the case may be. Elizabeth joins us now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I like to watch the Christmas classics like White Christmas, The Grinch, Rudolph, but I also like Pretty Woman.
Okay, is that part of your Christmas rotation, Pretty Woman, or is that for other parts of the year?
For other parts of the year.
Okay, I don't really see that as a Christmas movie. And then the Christmas ones, White Christmas, Rudolph, now do you wait till they pop up on TV, or do you stream them, or do you have the DVDs for those?
Have the DVDs and even videos for those, and watch those with my 21-year-old daughter. We love to watch them every year.
Is there a food that goes along with those Christmas movie traditions?
No, not especially.
Okay.
No, love to put the fireplace on and watch the movies, and yeah, they're great.
Lovely. Thank you so much for calling in, Elizabeth. We'll go now to Marcus in Madison. A lot of Madison people like to rewatch movies so far. Marcus, hi, what do you got for us?
Midnight Run.
All right, that's De Niro and Charles Grodin, is that right?
Absolutely. It is the greatest dialogue of any movie I've ever seen in my life.
And that's your odd couple, right? Charles Grodin's like a criminal accountant, and Robert De Niro is what, a bounty hunter, basically, right?
That's exactly right. You have seen it. It's an excellent movie. The dialogue, the interaction between the characters does not get any better.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go now to Mike with us in Appleton. Mike, hello.
Hi there. How are you guys doing today?
Good. What's your movie, Mike?
Oh, easily, Uncle Buck with John Candy.
Okay, now our producer, Bill Martins, if he's listening right now, just went crazy. He loves John Candy. He loves Uncle Buck. What is it about that movie that keeps you coming back, Mike? I've seen it, but it's been a while.
Mainly due to the fact that, you know, my dad will always joke with me a lot is, well, partially the fact I lived in the UP for 15 years, and I kind of sound a little like John Candy because he's from Toronto, partially, and also the fact that I kind of look like John Candy and with a little bit of a gut and what have you. And my two kids, my niece and my nephew, will look at the movie. They'll watch the movie. They'll look at me. They'll watch the movie. They'll look at me. They think it's a documentary.
That's great. Let's take a couple more of your calls now before we move on. Sharon in Union Grove. Sharon, hello.
Hello.
What do you rewatch?
My family favorite that we rewatch all the time is History of the World Part 1.
History of the World Part 1. Mel Brooks.
Yes. We can quote that movie almost every scene of it.
Fantastic. A historical comedy. One more caller. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your movie, Mark?
I actually had two that my family and I watch over and over. The first one is The Quiet Man with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara, and then To Catch a Thief with Grace Kelly and Cary Grant.
A couple classics there.
We're a classic family.
Wonderful. Mark, thank you so much. Thank you so much to everyone who called in. You can keep, tweet us. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's a good use of limited characters. What is the movie you rewatch again and again? You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is making the case for revisiting a landmark ruling on American libel law. The case dates back to 1964. It's known as New York Times versus Sullivan. It helped establish when the media can be sued for libel and what's necessary to win that kind of lawsuit. In an unrelated opinion this week, Thomas called on the court to reconsider the ruling, saying it was policy-driven and, quote, masquerading as constitutional law. Howard Schwaber is a First Amendment expert and professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, glad to be here.
Give us some background on this case, Howard. New York Times versus Sullivan. What led this to the Supreme Court?
So the history of this is fascinating. Libel is one of those areas that goes way back in common law. And up until the 1960s, there was absolute consensus that this was a matter for states to make laws about. There had been federal attempts to make laws about certain kinds of political speech, but in terms of personal libel, this was a matter of state law, and it always had been. In the 1960s, Southern authorities discovered they could use this law as a weapon to shut down the civil rights movement by filing lots and lots of libel suits for enormous sums of money against organizations, and in this case, Supreme Court case, the New York Times, on the grounds that if they had said something that was even the slightest bit false, the slightest error of fact, the slightest misstatement of an event, an Alabama or a Mississippi jury would return a harsh verdict, which would have the effect of draining the coffers of these organizations. It was really a matter of weaponizing a law that for centuries had served a basic civil function. So the Supreme Court was responding to that. And in order to protect the civil rights movement, they established this limit on the idea that any time you say something false about someone, they can sue you. And the limit they established in 1964 was really quite specific. It said elected public officials. If a newspaper, or anyone for that matter, says something about an elected public official that wasn't true, that public official couldn't recover damages unless they met the very high burden of showing that it had essentially been intentionally and maliciously false. What happened in the 20 years that followed is that rule was expanded farther and farther. So it went from protecting people who wanted to criticize elected public officials to people who wanted to criticize anyone who is a public figure, as far as to anyone who wanted to criticize someone who had appeared in the news. And so if you think, for example, about this case of some high school students from Covington Catholic High School in Washington, D.C., and one of those kids is now suing the Washington Post, most experts think he will have a very hard time winning because the fact that he appeared on the news makes him a public figure, and the Washington Post will be protected by this New York Times versus Sullivan rule. So it's become a real impediment to using law and the courts to silence even the most extreme kinds of vitriolic personal attacks on anyone who has any kind of public presence. And there's an argument that it helped open the door to the kind of extraordinarily harsh rhetoric that we see on the internet, for example, in political campaigns these days.
Why do we have these kinds of libel protections for the media?
Well, because if you go back to how all this started in the civil rights movement, without these protections, the traditional libel laws could be used as a weapon by political authorities to silence the press. And certainly throughout First Amendment doctrine, there's a very, very central idea that a free press is an essential part of a democracy. And Thomas, he made several arguments, and then he appealed to principles of originalism that not everyone will necessarily share. But he raised one really important point, which is that whatever argument you might think makes sense to protect the press against the politically powerful, it's not necessarily the case that you want to extend that same protection to anyone who wants to insult any public figure on the internet.
So Thomas is also saying it seems like we should go back to when the states themselves enforced libel laws. This is something that is beyond the purview of the federal government to say what should happen within any state. What do you make of that?
Right. So Thomas goes much farther than the critique I just made. I suggested, and I think lots of people who study this subject might agree, although others would disagree, that an initially positive idea to protect the free press against the possibility of being attacked by a kind of weaponized version of tort law of libel, that very positive idea has been expanded to the point where it becomes very, very difficult to protect anyone. Thomas wants to go, in fact, even further. He is, of course, an originalist, the most pure originalist of anyone on the court. And so he would turn the authority right back to the states, despite the dangers that states will use this kind of law in exactly the way that Alabama did in 1964.
Now, with this case, you mentioned this is Nicholas Sandman, one of the teenagers in this weird incident. It'd take an hour to sum up what may or may not have happened there. But it effectively saying, okay, the Washington Post got the story wrong. This is a everyday person, not a real public figure. They're asking for $250 million in damages, which is incidentally what Jeff Bezos paid for the Washington Post in the first place. Could someone make a case that, like, hey, this is just a teenager out in public? This isn't really a public figure.
Yes, exactly. Now, let me be clear. I think that the teenager's lawsuit is largely frivolous and primarily a kind of a career-launching stunt of a sort. But the idea, but that's not the question. The question is, by what kinds of tests or what kinds of rules should we assess a case like this? And the idea of treating this teenager as a public figure is light years away from the original idea of protecting the ability of the press to criticize elected officials. In this case, from what I know of the case, it doesn't appear the Washington Post did anything particularly wrong. In fact, they were rather careful. And as I say, I think this is a paper-thin lawsuit. But the idea that these standards of protection for criticizing elected officials should be extended to any actor, any musician, anyone who reports, in one famous case, who reports a crime to a journalist, anyone who appears on the Internet, that all these people become fair game by this high standard that has to be met before they can sue someone for defamation, that does seem to be a distortion of the 1964 idea of ensuring a press that would have untrammeled ability to critique elected officials. And, of course, Justice Thomas is quite right that it has absolutely nothing to do with the way people thought about libel in 1790.
Now, we have figures like Alex Jones, who parents of children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting have sued, accusing him of harassment, defamation for his claims that there were crisis actors, that a shooting never happened. Is there still room in current libel law for a case like that to be successful?
There is, and I should be clear that the Sullivan standard that we're talking about doesn't say no one can be sued. It just sets a very high bar. Alex Jones' actions were so malicious, so frankly vicious, and so obviously deliberate, you know, that it wasn't difficult for the plaintiffs to meet that bar. So it's not as though I used the phrase fair game. That was an exaggeration. It's not as though there are no protections of any kind. But the kind of unmitigated, obviously dishonest vitriol that we've seen directed at public figures in the last 20 years, and it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum you fall on, you will have, you know, a particular story you want to tell about this, does suggest that we may have gone too far in this judicially invented effort to protect the press and expanded it to a protection for general abusiveness. It's kind of striking that this is one of the very few areas of First Amendment law that no other constitutional court has adopted. There are a lot of American principles that constitutional courts in places like Australia and New Zealand and England and Europe have adopted as inspirations. As far as I know, no other country has adopted the Sullivan rule, and it's not that they haven't thought about it. It's been discussed and rejected.
Interesting. Howard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, talking to us about libel law and First Amendment protections for the press.